of Council of Jewish Women Oral History. This is Harold Kimmel and Arlene Shapiro interviewing Mark Stern on March 17, 1986 at his home on Tape 3, Side 2.
You want to start?
Yes.
Okay.
My first question.
Don't you put it on?
It's on.
It's on.
No. Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we got that straight.
Okay.
So my first question was, would you like to give us a little more detail about when you left Italy to come to the U.S.? What organizations, can you remember, helped you in Italy? Maybe the whole background.
All right. I think it should be covered a little bit better than this year.
All right.
In the story I told you that I was picked up by the Americans in the trucks and taken to Italy. And when we came to Italy, we were in a refugee camp. And one of the first people that helped us was the American Army. And the people that frequented these refugee camps were Palestine Brigade. These were the Jewish soldiers that were from Palestine, that served in the English Army. And they knew about us, and they came to see who was there. And this is how I found out about my brother and his message to me. But after a while, the Palestine Brigade was organizing illegal Aliyah bait to Palestine, and they were the first one to be in touch with us. This was in the South Italy, in the Hakshara kibbutz that we have organized there. And actually, the organization of the second Hakshara in Fano, which is North Italy, where we built a ship, was also through their help. The UNRWA was an official organization that helped.
UNRWA.
UNRWA. UNRWA. UNRWA is in existence even now.
What does it stand for?
United Nations Refugee Assistance or something like
yeah.
that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, UNRWA has provided us with food and provided us with what we needed to survive.
Mm-hmm.
In the camps?
In the camps. In the refugee camps.
That's the DP, the Displaced Person Camp?
Displaced Person Camp. And later on, when I left the Hakshara, because we have decided to go to America, my wife received the papers, we were married already, and since we were going to America, we did not stay, we did not want to stay on the Hakshara, where everybody was building themselves up to go illegally to Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
When we came to a refugee camp, which was an open refugee camp, in Rome, Italy, in Cinecittà, this is the town where they used to make movies. There were barracks, they put us there. They have provided us, through Joint Distribution Committee, with monies to be able to register in the school in Italy. And Joint was also helpful when we needed to pay for the tickets to go on the ship to come to America. And as I have mentioned, I think the last time we talked, I have paid back that money through the American, New American Association, which was connected with Joint, as far as I remembered. We have also made contributions to Joint and other refugee organizations, obviously, remembering what we went through. But this is basically the organizations that were helpful to us, the official post-war organizations.
So, actually, there was only one Jewish organization, the Joint Distribution, that contacted you.
They didn't contact specifically. For the whole camp. They actually had asked if anybody needs assistance to go to school, to educate, because we were young people, that our education was interrupted.
Yeah.
And we were trying to build a future, and they were trying to help us.
And in New York, were there organizations that helped?
In New York, when I came to America, one of the first ones that I went to was the Association for the New Americans. and I asked him for assistance in getting a job. I was not successful to get assistance through them, although I heard some people were. So I went through the newspaper ads, and I have received jobs through the newspaper ads.
Mm-hmm. But again, not through a Jewish organization?
Well, the Association for the New Americans.
Was that Jewish?
Yes.
Oh.
They were in New York, and it was a Jewish-based organization.
Mm-hmm. I have that in all the services that were offered. In the services that were offered to you in the U.S., even up to now, I don't mean this particular period, but when you had a move, did anyone else offer you any services?
No, I really didn't need any services from any organization for the simple reason that my wife and myself, from the beginning on, we started working. Mm-hmm. I was employed as long as I'm in America, since 1947. I don't think I had 2 days I was out of a job without employment. So we always managed to more than support ourselves, and we're able to help ourselves with whatever we needed. We did get help. We took advantage of programs like adult education programs to learn English. Mm-hmm. You have to understand, when I came to America, I didn't speak any English language. So I went first to public school in Brooklyn, and then I went to Brooklyn College. And my main objective was to learn English. And then I went to two colleges. One I started was aeronautics. I wanted to go for aerospace engineering, and I didn't succeed because it was too difficult for me to study. I couldn't work and study. So I took a part-time study and Bernard Baruch Accounting School in New York, and that's where my background comes from.
Now, during all that time, you kept a kosher home?
Always. My wife comes from a very traditional home. I come from a traditional home. We ate kosher at home, and of course, during the war, no. During the war, we ate horse meat if we could get hold of it. Because the hunger had to be satisfied somewhere, and there wasn't too much to eat. But after the war, in our home, there was never anything else but kosher.
Well, at what period did you become an American citizen? The year?
Exactly 5 years after I was in America. I made sure that I didn't waste one day. From the day that I came in, my application went in according to the law when you had to, and I came in to receive my papers exactly 5 years to the day
really?
I came in.
What year then? Let's repeat.
52. In 1947 I came, and around June 1952 I got my American citizenship papers.
In other words, I didn't know that.
And my wife
takes
received that
5 years.
Yeah, you have to be for 5 years in the country to do that.
I see.
I had a little in between. I was working in a candy store. In 1949, I had my own candy store. And there was an ad in the paper that anybody that knows languages, they're asking him to sign up to become part of CIA service. And since the opportunity was to get your citizenship earlier, and I felt very strongly for America since I came here, to become an American, I actually applied for a job, and it took them something like a year to find out that I can be a CIA agent because they cleared my records. But by then my wife was pregnant, and when they called, I said, I'm sorry.
You can shut me. Wait. Oh, is it on?
So, obviously, my wife was pregnant, and I said, no, I cannot go for the services. And they said, but we have investigated, and we want you to be sworn in and be in the service, and you were interested. And I said, sorry. I was a little bit afraid because I didn't know that in America you have right to say no when you want to. But they never bothered me, and I guess they have someplace a record that I just turned around and said no. But
you said no to them?
I said no to them.
They were going to hire you?
They had cleared my record, and they said that I can't be an agent for America because my record is clear.
Even though you weren't
a citizen? It took them a year. No, they checked out my background all over the world. You have to understand, I was in America only about 3 years, 4 years.
Uh-huh.
And they weren't going to get me into CIA service. A guy that comes from Europe without knowing who I am.
But you mean they checked everything and didn't know you weren't a citizen?
I don't know where they checked it, because it took them a year to check.
And they never found out you weren't a citizen?
Oh, yeah, they knew
I
was.
Okay.
Because I wasn't a citizen, they had no record of who I am. You know, when you apply, they ask you those questions. Where do you come from? Where were you? And which places you were? And they check every day. The fact is that I was clear. I know about it, but they didn't know. And of course, the fact is that my two sons have a clearance, a top security clearance, and they're working for the government indirectly.
Interesting.
So that maybe that's not a prerequisite to be an American citizen when you work for the CIA.
I guess not.
No, that isn't. You don't have to be.
Right.
You can be a fine living someplace and they hire you.
Exactly.
Right? And I was here with the idea that I'm going to become an American. And I just mentioned it because it was an interesting thing that they checked my background.
And you were okay.
And they found out that I'm clear. Like I didn't know it.
All right. The other question I had here was how and what influenced you to go from New York to Pittsburgh?
Okay. All right. I'm not going to go through all the jobs that I had in New York. All I say that the last job that I had in New York before I came to Pittsburgh was working for the Jewish Theological Seminary, conservative movement, as an administrator of resident camping. And the camp that I was managing administratively was at Glenspey, Massachusetts, and the son of Rabbi Goblin from Beth Shalom was working for me there. And then his other son, David, came to work for me also. So he had two sons working for me, and he came to visit them.
Nice.
And he met me. And a year later, they came in back to work, and he met me again, and he said they are looking for an executive director of Congregation Beth Shalom. And I heard rumors that you going to be leaving Ramah, would you be interested in getting an interview? And I said, yeah, that's a good idea. And that's how I came in for an interview, and that's how I was hired to Congregation Beth Shalom as an administrator.
Well, about the camp, could you give us a little detail? What sort of camp was it? Young people, middle-aged?
Camp Ramah is a camp that accepts school children from Hebrew religious schools, from conservative movement only.
Mm-hmm.
It's a camp where the children learn to speak Hebrew. It's a Hebrew-speaking camp where the head of the camp usually is a rabbi. The teachers, many of them are rabbis. The other ones have shlichim, the messengers from Israel to bring their culture to the camp.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very intensive educational. When we had 600 campers, we had 400 staff. So you can imagine, we had town of 1,000.
My God, yes.
Including infirmary, with a doctor, nurses, with a hospital, a little hospital, two kitchens, cooks, bakers. And during the winter month, we were hiring these people. We were signing up the people to come to the camp. And in this summer, I used to go about a month before the summer there to set up the camp to make sure it's right. Of course, during the winter time, we did some alterations or whatever. I had a maintenance man who lived there. But then in the beginning of the summer, I brought in the crew of people with me. The fact is that from beginning of June to the last day of camp, which usually was around the end of August, I used to be 20 pounds lighter, and I had to use my wardrobe. That was the after camp wardrobe. And then before the camp again, I used the other wardrobe. school.
Well, what?
Very intensive work.
Yes. Mm-hmm. How did you get involved in that? Through what?
How did I come to the
camp?
Hadn't you been in a shipping business before?
Right. I was in Israeli shipping company. Okay. I was working for American Israeli company that had the headquarters of their branch, American branch, in New York. And I was working there first as an accountant, first as a bookkeeper. Then I became an accountant. Mm-hmm. From accounting, I was hired to become an office manager there. They enlarged from a small office of less than 30 people to over 100 people in there.
Wow.
And I planned the office because of my engineering background. I was able to lay out the office. I was negotiating the contracts for rental of the office. And I did hiring of the people and set up everything. And when we opened the agency with the new staff of over 100 people, the day they walked in, within 15 minutes, everybody was working. They even had sharpened pencils on his desk, on their desks.
Mm.
And as a reward for it, the company has allowed me, or offered me, free ticket for my wife and two kids on their ship to go to Israel. They went on SS Israel, they came back on SS Zion. And since it takes 4 weeks, 2 weeks to go and 2 weeks to back, and we'll spend a month in Israel, I didn't want to waste that much time, so I flew in. They gave me a ticket at 75% discount as an agent to go to Israel. And this is the first time I met my brother after 20 odd years. And this is how we came to that. So obviously my background was very Jewish. I liked Hebrew and I liked being connected with anything that has to do with Israel, with Hebrew, with Israel, Shlichim, with Israel, sailors.
Mm.
I also liked education, and since I felt that I wanted to work for Klal Israel, what was a better way than in the education with children? And that's how I got into the Ramah from Zimlitz.
Zim, Z-I-M.
Z-I-M.
Are they still in business?
Oh, yes. What Zim Israel Navigation is mostly freighter company now. They went out of passenger business.
I see.
And they have container ships. They offered me a job before. The week that I was coming to Pittsburgh to take over my job, I got a telephone call from them. They heard that I left my other job, and they asked me to become a controller of their container operation.
Mm.
With more money than Bet Shalom. But there were two reasons that I didn't want to. Number one, I don't believe in going back where I left. And second, I had a commitment. And once I made a commitment, I wasn't going to change it. And money wasn't that important. I was very excited about going to work in a synagogue. I thought, especially what I saw here, I liked. When I came for an interview to Pittsburgh, I found it a most friendly community. I found that the people that interviewed me were very nice people. I found that the organization itself was serving the public well.
Mm-hmm.
And my decision was that I'm going to come here. It was the right time. My children already finished high school. They were going to go to college. The last one was going to go to college. So it was a perfect time for that.
What time? I'm just curious. Was it winter, spring?
This was in, I always changed it this summer. I don't know why. June.
Mm.
At summer.
No, this was May. May of 1973.
Wow.
But it's somehow the things always happen during the summer with me.
So now you move into an entirely different atmosphere, Pittsburgh.
That's right.
So we can get from you, you just gave us a little of your feelings about the people in Pittsburgh. How did you feel about them in other areas, for example, in the religious area? How did it feel to be involved in a conservative American temple in Pittsburgh?
Conservative congregation?
Compared to your background. Yeah.
My background was Orthodox, true. My background was Orthodox because of my grandparents rather than my parents. My parents didn't know. They were Orthodox, but they weren't really. They were conservative. conservative, mm-hmm. maybe traditional kind of, like today. There's many, I mean, today the conservative traditional Jew works even on Saturday, mm-hmm. because he feels he has a commitment to his job, mm-hmm. he has to do that. His way of maintaining his traditionalism is through commitment to Judaism, through tzedaka, through prayers, through maintaining the holidays, mm-hmm. and kashrut, etc. So my father was this kind of a person, so I fitted perfectly into it. As a matter of fact, in New York, I did not belong to Orthodox anymore. I was part of a conservative synagogue. Mm-hmm. I felt more comfortable in it. I wanted to be with my family together. I didn't want the separation of men and women. And as long as it was traditional, it was just what I wanted. And times are changing, and we are changing with the times. So obviously now, as the times are changing, I even believe that the conservatives might be a little bit too strict. So this is something that is in process of changing in the conservative movement, at least in my opinion.
Too strict or not changing quickly enough?
Well, it's no, the quickly it doesn't matter. It has to be changing with times. The mm-hmm. conservative religion bases are that we are halachically Jewish, but we maintain our Jewish halacha within the style of life of today. We are not trying to fit in into the pre-electric times, progress times. There's a progress in society, there's a way of life, the same way as today women go to work. Also, more women get active in synagogue. Also, more women should be active as leadership of the synagogue. At one time, who could think of a woman being a president of a synagogue? But this was at one time. They forgot very easily that in the Bible, they have our four mothers, or how do you call it, the female forefathers, who were very active in the Jewish religion, and they are mentioned in the Bible. So there's no reason for us to say that they have no place. They have place. They have a very strong place there.
Furthermore, I mean, in addition to that, I see you, did you watch Beth Shalom change as you were active in it? Did they give a little with the modernization?
Well, let's put it this way. I think that I was kind of instrumental in some of the changes that came with Beth Shalom. I would say that when I came to Beth Shalom, not only financially we were embarrassed, but our congregation was older than it is now. There were very few young couples. The young people didn't find that it's the thing to do to join Beth Shalom. And I worked very hard on promoting the service to the young people. Of course, had a lot of help from the lay leadership, from the lay people, from the Jewish philanthropists, mm-hmm. who understood the problem when I presented it, and they were willing to subsidize it. And just to mention one of them, you talk about a man like Mr. Joseph Elias, who single-handedly subsidized a singles program and the young couples program in our synagogue, because he was convinced that if we can provide the services, we're going to awaken the Jewish life in the community. I was lucky that I was able to convince him. Mm-hmm. And some of these programs worked then and work now. And I feel that this was my main achievement in Beth Shalom. In addition, of course, to the finances, which I have also overcome the burdens through the good grace of other donors and with help of other lay leadership.
Can you mention some of these donors, if you can remember their names, who were outstanding in furthering
I will never forget a man who is not alive. I like to talk about people that are gone, because the people forget too easily. Some people don't talk too kindly, Mr. Sam Hyman. I personally think he was a great man. He supported many Jewish causes in the Jewish community in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. My experience with him was fantastic. That's the only word that I can say. You know, when you go to a man, you present to him how to overcome the deficits, how to change the management of the cemetery. He became immediately a cemetery chairman. He became immediately active on our finance committee, and we worked very closely. In the beginning, when I needed $10,000 to meet our mortgage payment, and the money wasn't there, of course, in the beginning, he just called me up and he said, come on over, the check is ready. And didn't give 10, but he gave 20 because he says, you're not going to have next month either. This is how generous this man was. He is followed now by his daughter, Alanov, Yeta Alanov and Saul, who are active. The person that in my mind was a vision at Beit Shalom was Dr. William Stark, who has built magnificent building, who was active in raising funds to pay that mortgage. You know, some of our donors might not be most pleasant to everybody in one way, but they have their strength. And he was tremendous in that area. We had Marvin Lieber, who was active in our education and was also active in providing our legal assistance.
What was that name again?
Marvin Lieber.
Oh, Marvin Lieber.
But I think that what is most important to remember, that the little people at Beit Shalom were more meaningful than anybody else. They always responded. We were always most fortunate to raise equal monies from people that maybe didn't have as much as the people I have mentioned, but they were giving with a full heart. And giving in heavier doses percentage-wise than the big givers. And this is what I'm proud of.
That's very interesting. Now, because I want it made clear on the tape, there were many Hymans in Pittsburgh. Was Sam Hyman the real estate Sam Hyman?
That's right.
Yes.
West Penn Realty.
The other Hyman was
this is the Hyman,
automobiles.
That's right. This is the Hyman that started with selling shoelaces and then went into real estate business.
Mm-hmm. And Stark was the gentleman in the laundry business.
No, he's a dentist.
Oh, Dr. Stark. See, we got to get that clear.
Dr. William Stark is a dentist who was a president of Beit Shalom at one time and built originally the school and built a large synagogue. And many people don't think very kindly of him, and this is what I'm saying. That he deserved mention because of his strength of wanting to always come out and work for the synagogue. And I'm not getting involved in politics because politics and synagogue exists. And this is one black mark there is in any synagogue. This is one thing that I never liked. But we had many very good presidents, people that led this synagogue to be known as the educational institution. I pride myself that I was helpful to many of them. I was the right hand in a way because I had to know the bylaws. I had to keep it within the law, within the way the organization has to be operated. I had to bring up ideas of how to raise funds, which came from me and were developed with many of them. Mm-hmm. It's too many to mention. I mentioned nothing. I mentioned just two, three people.
Yeah.
But all these people were very active. Mm-hmm. And all the people that you don't think of, like the people that I just mentioned one, because Ernest Nachman will stay in the mind of many people in this community. A man who is always available. Little people don't have much money, but they give. They give more than they can afford. Mm-hmm. And there's so many of them. You know, we would stay here for hours talking about names if we would start that.
We have to turn the tape, but I hope I can put this on there because I have worked with Mark. And the reason for Beth Sholem's success, I think, is a great deal of it is because of Mark's ability to make people understand the need and the problem and that how everything helps. Mm-hmm. And I really think it's a tribute to Mark.
Thank you very much. I'm glad that you said it, but I tell you something. I went to work in the field of synagogues for a reason, to serve people. And we have served people well. There's nobody from Congregation Beth Shalom, a member, that would come to our congregation for want or advice, help, and that was refused. Nobody. Because they always could find mm-hmm. help. And there's nobody, unless they look for an excuse that couldn't straighten out any misunderstandings. And that misunderstanding, you have to understand, when you have 1,000 families, when you deal with over 2,000 people, there has to be misunderstanding. Mm-hmm. But if they are willing to come in, to open up, mm-hmm. to discuss, they were always served mm-hmm. because this is what I believe. We, as a congregation, serve the community.
And it's a tribute to you that it did it so well. It's true, Mark.
I believe in doing it. I mean, I think I mentioned one of the things that I think that the Almighty allowed me to survive so I can be helpful in some people to do well mm-hmm. in this world. And my choice is Jewish people. So if I can work in the Jewish field and work for people, mm-hmm.